I'm at a disadvantage because most all of you already know what we're planning to study tonight. But I want us to, and this has to be brief, briefly look at what we are encountering in the world at this time. The world empire that we learned about last night that has just crumbled in 539 BC. Remember Belshazzar, Daniel 5? Was what empire? Babylon. Babylon has fallen. But prior to Babylon's fall, God's people have been taken into captivity, 605, 597, 586, by the Babylonians. And Jeremiah had prophesied that they would be captive for how long? 70 years. That time period has ended, 539 BC. A new king from what empire comes upon the throne? Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel told us about that, remember, as he explained the vision? And that empire was in fact named in the picture of Daniel chapter 8. Remember the ram with the two horns? And so now we're looking at the Persians. And what was the name of the king that said to the Jewish people, go home and rebuild your temple? Cyrus. And so Cyrus has indeed allowed the people to go home, reversing the political process of the Babylonians of deporting people. Cyrus sends them back home, which is actually a very good thing for political relations. And so we also remember reading about another man in the book of Daniel. Remember, Daniel is, of course, in his 70s to 80s, maybe 90, when he's thrown into the lion's den. Remember Darius? And so we've got Cyrus and we've got a Darius king. And now we're going to have another Persian king tonight. And so we're following on in time. And the book that we're studying about tonight fits between what two chapters of the book of Ezra? Between chapters 6 and 7. Because what we have is we have a gap of 80 years between the beginning of the book of Ezra, which is about when? When does the book of Ezra begin approximately? 539, 538, 536, somewhere around there. And then the second half of the book of Ezra is not going to get started until about 458, 457. So we've got an 80-year gap there, but there's another story that God wants us to know about between chapters 6 and 7. It's the story of whom? It's the story of Esther. There are two Bible books named for women. What's the other book? Ruth. And I want you to notice the unique place that Jesus has in both those books. You know, a lot of times we think, well, these are just Old Testament history books. Why in the world is the book of Ruth in the Bible? Well, it tells us a lot about the period of Judges. It tells us about faithful women outside of Israel. But who is uniquely being foretold in the book of Ruth? Christ. Christ, because Ruth is a great-great, I never remember exactly all how far back it is, a great, let's say, grandmother of whom? King David. And remember these grand promises, kingly promises, throne promises that are made to David, and then Acts 2 tells us that's Jesus. So Jesus is being told about in the book of Ruth. Will Jesus have anything to do with the book of Esther? Think about it. We'll get there. All right, so we've done some background now, and we're about ready to identify her. One of the things that's enjoyable to do, especially with children, are these little cards that are called Who Am I cards. You already know the answer, but let's see if we could run down some of these biographical sketch remarks to give people clues for Esther. Since you already know who she is, let me just try this one on you. Her real name is what? I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Hadassah. Hadassah. We probably wouldn't remember that, would we? It's kind of like, now, who are the parents of Moses? You know, we don't typically remember those kind of things. But that's her real name. Remember how we had people's names change because they're being transported to other places? So this girl is an orphan, right? Mom and dad are dead. And she's reared by her cousin. Older translations, King James, I think, says uncle. Actually, as you find a relationship, that was a term used in the King James period in the 1600s, which referred to cousins. You just find that with nephew in the book of, I think it's 1 Timothy. So he's a cousin, and he rears her, and she's living 700-900 miles away from home, her homeland. She's really, what? Read my mind. She's really beautiful. And from a character standpoint, she's a, or is a relationship with guys. She's a virgin. She's a beautiful young virgin. She's got a cousin named Mordecai. She wins a beauty contest in Persia in the capital city named Susa. Shushan, I think, is the way it's spelled in older translations. Most of us today, we would see it spelled Susa. It's beyond Babylon, even farther east, about 100 miles or so. And what does she do? Why is this book in the Bible? What does Esther do with God's help, obviously? Saves her people from what? Extinction. Extermination. Why is that such a big deal? What if her nation was exterminated? Is that any big deal? Yeah, because there goes Christ. There go all the promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and David. They're all gone. But God had made promises, and He's going to keep His promises. And so that's the book of Esther, and there's where Christ is in all of that, in what has been done for us through God providentially in the life of Esther. So that might help you then in regard to as you're answering some of the questions. Esther is her name as she lives in her Persian domain. This book is written about when? Maybe you've got, you know, some Bibles have this page that tells you background information, tells you dates and things like that. My Bible doesn't have that, but I like the thinness of it, so I have to write in that stuff. So what would you write down for a date here? I can tell you that it's in the third year of the reign. See that in verse 3? So that tells me the date, doesn't it? Third year of the reign of this king. Well, pardon? 486 is probably the right date for when he starts. For when he starts his reign. What's the guy's name? Let you pronounce it. All right, you took the easy one. I used to hear it pronounced Ahasuerus. Now that reminds me of Hungarian because every vowel is pronounced in Hungarian. And I like to just put that U and E together, so I'm just going to say Ahasuerus. And I might just try to make it easier on myself and call him Xerxes, because that seems to be the man in Persian history that this really is identifying. Do you remember the name of the king, for example, back when the Exodus occurred in Egypt? Remember the king's name? Well, what do we always call him? Pharaoh. Well, that's actually a title. That's really not his name. I thought it was always his name. But it's actually a man's title. So this Ahasuerus might be a title for these Persian kings. The man's name, from all indication, chronologically and historically, is Xerxes. But that's not easy to pronounce either, so we'll just call him king, okay? And so that's who we're looking at, and we're looking at a period from 486 down to about 465. He's going to reign for about 20 years, so it's real helpful to write that down in your Bible. And then if we're in the third year, if we're at 485, 486, we're about down to 483. And I'm going to say about. I've got preacher friends who say, it's 485 for sure. Well, maybe so, but I've got a note here that says 483 on the third year. So that may not be right, but that's pretty close. So that gives us a little bit of background. Wonder who the author of this book is. Do you know who wrote this book? Who wrote this book? Don't know. It's unknown. Author doesn't say who he is, or maybe even she is, probably a he. But it most likely was a Jew who lived in that time period and had written these events after they had occurred. Where does this book fit? You know, Mo was asking us how many books in the Old Testament. Where does this book fit in regard to the historical books of the Old Testament? Remember the 5-12, 5-5-12 thing? Five books of law, 12 books of history. Which one of those 12 books of history is this one? It's the last one, isn't it? It's the last in the list because next thing we know, we're into poetry with Job. But yet the events of this book are earlier than the events in the book of Nehemiah and the last few chapters of Ezra. So I want you to understand that just because the book is placed here doesn't mean this is the end of the Old Testament or the end of Old Testament history. And so that is helpful to know as you think about the sequence of events. Well, let me tell you just very briefly about this king. You probably wouldn't want to have been married to him, ladies. You probably already know that by reading this wonderful history. I mean, this is gripping. This is great drama. So many times we kind of put down the Bible as it's not very good literature. It's a lot better than most literature today. It's great stuff. It just is spellbound. And so here King Xerxes is. Secular historians tell us that he reigned for approximately 20 years between Darius I and Artaxerxes. You remember that from last night's information. History tells us about him that he was a hothead. He would be intensively angry. His rage would be out of control. He would do things like have some men build a bridge over the Hellespont. Then a big storm would come and break the bridge down, and he would say, "All right, you take a scourge and you whip that sea with 30 lashes. No, excuse me, 300 lashes." whipping the water with a scourge is really going to change things. But he also had the bridge builders. Well, they didn't do that one so well, so off with their heads. That's the kind of fellow he was. Morally, he was a mixture of passionate extremes. What does he do to Vashti or Vashti when she will not display herself, when she doesn't come and show off who she is in front of all the men? "You're gone. You're gone. We'll get you. Get us another one. In fact, we'll check out several of them." And that's the kind of individual he was. He, without any problem, gives his ring away so somebody can massacre the Jews. And then he takes the ring from one man, having him hung, and then gives the ring to somebody else so those people can then massacre their enemies. Wouldn't you just love to have him for president? Well, they had him for king. And so that's where those people live. Whose name is not in this book? Y'all know that, don't you? God's name is not in here. But he's in every page. You see him working all through this work. And so what I'd like for us to do now is just go through and tell the story. Pardon? I have no idea, but I'd sure be glad for you to enlighten us. Okay. All right. And so we're going to see what we might call L-U-C-K. Luck. We're just going to cast lots. We're just going to see. We're just going to flip a dime for it. God can even be involved when you flip a coin. And we'll see how they cast lots and how it works out to the benefit of God's people. So let's just kind of walk through this. I'm going to turn my back to you. I hope that's not too rude as you follow through these events with us. Wonder who the fellow is on the right up there in the purple robe. Any idea? That's probably the king. We'll call him King, or Xerxes. And how long does he party? You know, he has this big party. How long do they party? 6 months. Yeah, I had to think 180 days. They've having a big party so he can show off all his stuff. And so they party for about 6 months, had plenty to drink during that time. I don't know if it was intoxicating or not, but the guys tend to lose their head in some of their thinking in regard to that. After that time then, maybe, there we go, I went too far. There's this pretty young girl. She's an orphan, and she is raised by her cousin Mordecai after her parents die. Where does she live? Where does she live? Oh, we can say Persia, can't we? But then she's selected after Vashti or Vashti is deposed. I wonder about Vashti. Do you think maybe she just refused to display herself? Do you think there might have been a sense of modesty in her rejection? For one reason or another, she says, "No, I'm not coming, King. I'm not coming to display myself in front of all you people." But then this young lady, along with, I wonder how many other young women. How many provinces are there in Persia? 127, so there's plenty to choose from. And so Hadassah is chosen as one. But Mordecai tells her not to do what? Don't tell your nationality. Don't tell where you're from. You just think of it, young ladies. You've gone from being a slave, or at least a captive, in a foreign nation. And next thing you know, you're put in a harem kind of setting, in a preparation so that you've got servants under you. Next thing you know, you're going to be going into the king one night and stay till morning. You'll notice in the text it talks about virgins. I've often wondered about how she handled that situation, ladies. Going in to please the king one night and coming and being put in the harem of the concubines after that. I don't want to suggest anything inappropriate in her character, but it does give us cause to think about the difficulty she was facing as a beautiful young woman and the king wanting to make choice for a new queen. And he chooses her, calls her in for a second interview, and he chooses her. He's more pleased with her than all of the other women in his kingdom. And this is a bunch of people. But he chooses her, and think about how she could have lost her head in regard to the opportunities that would be hers as the queen of the most powerful empire in the world. And so we notice that she is extremely beautiful. She's really beautiful. Well, what really makes a woman beautiful? I would suggest to you it's character. Jacqueline Bisset once said that character contributes to beauty. It fortifies a woman as her youth fades. A mode of conduct, a standard of courage, discipline, fortitude, and integrity can do a great deal to make a woman beautiful. And so she indeed is a beautiful woman. God said that real value and real beauty, real good looks, are located where? Inside, in the heart. And so Eliab, the big, strong, strapping son, was not chosen. The little ruddy boy, David, was chosen. And so, ladies, there is beauty in character. Well, she's got a cousin, and he sits out by the king's gate, and one day he hears about a what? A plot, a conspiracy, a plan. A couple of guys are looking to do the king in. And so he then reports that, and there's nothing ever done about it, any kind of appreciation, but it's what? So that later it could be found out. It's reported and it's written down in the chronicles of the king. You just kind of hold that in your memory then. And so there's another fellow in chapter 3 who is named what? He's a big shot. Haman. Hammedatha. He is an Agagite. Now, does Agag kind of ring a bell? Agag. You ever heard that name before? Agag. Agag. Now, there was a king back in Israel named Saul. And Saul was to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites, and they had a king named Agag. You might hold on to that. Seems like that this fellow is somehow related to old Agag. Well, whatever happened to Agag anyway? I think Saul kind of let him live, didn't he? But then Samuel didn't. that's succinct. He didn't. Yeah, there we go. And by the way, what tribe is Mordecai from? He's from Benjamin. What tribe was Saul from? Benjamin. Interesting. Well, Haman, he gets to be basically second man under the king. He is extremely popular, and he's got a lot of money. He offers 10,000 talents of silver to get rid of certain people. But now everybody else does what when Haman walks by? Worships, reveres, bows down. In fact, that's the very idea of worship. But who doesn't bow down and worship him as if he's some kind of god? Mordecai. Why doesn't Mordecai bow down and worship him? Because he's a Jew. Just because he's Jewish, he doesn't? Is there anything in regard to God and the Jews and worship? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Worship me and worship me only. And so that's his reason. And so as we continue then, Haman, he really likes Mordecai because he sees in Mordecai a man of courage and self-discipline. Am I kind of missing that? Yeah, pretty badly. He actually what, Mordecai? He hates him. He despises him. He gets in a rage about it, but he's pretty good at controlling it when he needs to. So he goes to the king and he says, "Oh, king, you've got this people in your kingdom that they just really aren't good for your kingdom. You need to get rid of them. And I will pay you 10,000, isn't it, talents of silver to get rid of them." Evidently, he had a lot of money. So the king says, "Well, I can use the money for my treasure chest." Is that what the king says? Basically, the king says, "You can keep your money." But Haman then is able to convince the king, "I need your ring. I need to have your name on this document." And he announces a document. He's been casting lots, casting pur, from the first month. I think it's about, is it the 13th day or 23rd day? And then it finally is going to fall to, when is this going to come down that these Jews are going to be exterminated? Adar. It's going to be the 12th month. So he's got some time to get his plans all in place. And now that the document's been signed and sealed, it's got to be delivered. And so you've got couriers. And you see the guy on the camel? Well, they've got to go through wilderness. They've got to go through desert. They've got a big empire to cover. And so the message is going to go out. And who's going to not be happy about the news? The Jews. Jews over all this huge expanse are grieving. And they're doing what to their clothes to show their grief? Tearing their clothes, ripping their clothes, and they're lying on, some of them are wearing what? Sackcloth. Help me with that sackcloth. I wanted to do more study today. What is sackcloth? Maybe I did. We read about it a lot. Sackcloth. Seems to be a rough kind of a hairy, bristly kind of fabric, isn't it? For some reason I was thinking something about goat's hair. Yeah, that's it. That's right. Oh, remember with potato sacks? You know, burlap? Just something to be rough to the skin, and it would remind you that things weren't right. And then they would lie on ashes and grieve over these terrible conditions. So the Jews are terribly sad. Who else is sad, by the way? Esther is. She's grieved. And when she hears that Mordecai is going around in sackcloth and ashes, she sends him what? To get him fixed up. Sends him a change of clothes, but he won't accept that. And she's grieved over all this. But what might she be thinking when she hears this news? What might she be thinking? Pardon? I think maybe at first she was thinking, you know, hey, I'm queen. Won't happen to me. Besides, I'm married to the richest guy in the empire. I've got influence. I've got people that I know. These things that might happen to my people might not happen to me. Who tells her, just because you're here in the king's palace doesn't mean you're not a Jew too? Who tells her that? Cousin Mordecai. So then she, being reminded of who she really is, says, I need you to do something for me. My maids and I, we're going to what? We're going to pray and we're going to fast for 3 days. All you Jews in this city, you do that too. And so that's what they're doing. Praying and fasting. And then she says these famous words in chapter 4, isn't it? If I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. Well, what's she mean, if I die, I die? She's just going to go talk to her husband. Yeah, if you weren't invited to speak to him, what happened? Do you remember when Nehemiah, I'm getting ahead of myself, Nehemiah was a little concerned about that too, wasn't he? That the king might not be real happy today. And so if the scepter is not spread out to her, she's dead. She's gone. But indeed, he sees her. He is told that she's outside. He's welcomed in. But he notices something about her. What does he notice about her emotional state? She's grieved. She's distressed. And so he wants to know what's wrong. She says, will you do what? Will you come to a banquet today and bring Haman? And then they go to the banquet. And then she says, will you come to another banquet tomorrow? And tomorrow I'll ask what my request is. So that's good news. So Haman, you know, you can just see him walking like a peacock as he walks out of there. and he thinks he's great, and he goes to tell his wife, Zeresh, and all of his friends, the king and me, we were the only two invited to the banquet, just us. And so he's feeling pretty good about it, and his wife says, you know, I'll just get rid of that old Mordecai, because even if king thinks you're great, Mordecai won't bow down to you. So they build a gallows to hang Mordecai that's, what, about 75 feet high? So they build that gallows, and he's going to go in tomorrow morning, but it just so happens that that night the king can't what? And if there's anything to put you to sleep, it's reading the encyclopedia. You know? And so he says, here, start reading the Chronicles. You know, all these political documents that the king has recorded. And it just so happens that the guy who's reading to him is reading to him about whom? Mordecai, and what had been done, how Mordecai had thwarted the plot to have him killed. So he gets to thinking, you know what, really ought to do something for Mordecai. So Haman walks in the next morning, and the king says, what should I do to give honor and glory to the one whom the king desires to honor? And Haman thinks, well, who could he want to honor more than me? So he then says, well, you ought to get him on a royal steed, put a royal robe on him, and just fix him up and say, this is what the king does to those whom he wants to honor. Well, Haman's thinking he's going to be riding. So then what does the king tell him? You go get Mordecai, put him on the horse, and do all the things you've said. So he runs home, and his wife says, you're in trouble. And he comes back to the banquet, and then Esther pleads for her life and for the life of her people, the Jews. And while the king has stepped out, Haman is pleading for his life to Queen Esther. And the king comes back in, and it doesn't look good to the king what is being done. Haman is what? He's hanged on the gallows he built for Mordecai. But has that solved all the problems? We've still got this 10 months or so later time where all the Jews are going to be what? And once a Persian king signs a document and puts his signet ring on it, what's going to happen with that law? It can never be changed. It can never be changed. So there's going to have to be another law written then to enable the Jews to defend themselves. So here comes proclamation number 2, and the Jews are told that they're allowed to defend themselves on the 12th month, and I believe, isn't it the 13th or 14th day of the month? I believe it's the 13th day of the 12th month. That would be, I think, springtime if we're looking at Jewish calendar. And so the Jews are able to defend themselves. And that's wonderful. And God keeps his people from being destroyed. So, we need to do some texture work. Now you know the rest of the story. Now we need to know why. What I was so bitterly disappointed in last night in my own efforts is I didn't do what I told you. We didn't deal with the so what. It doesn't matter if we know the storylines. It doesn't matter if we know all the names and all the places and all the dates. It's so what that matters. And we'll try tomorrow night to do a little more of the so what in the first 6 chapters of Ezra. But I don't want to let that opportunity get away from us tonight. Would you notice on page 2 in your outline? God perform any miracles in this story? Any supernatural suspension of law in these events? No, not. You know, and sometimes it's hard to know. You know, I've thought as a kid, people have asked me, what's the difference between providence and miracles? And I've used Route 2 as an example for 25 years. Have you ever driven along Route 2 and all of a sudden there's a boulder coming down the hill and it falls and rolls across Route 2 right in front of you? What do you call that? Luck? Phew! Close call? Now, what if that rock was coming down and all of a sudden it just started hovering, just stopped right in midair over top of your car? What would you call that? That's a miracle. Because God injected a force super above the natural realm. If natural law was happening, what would have happened to you and your car? You'd been squished like a little bug. All right? But in this case, God suspends natural law. There's no suspension of natural law that we see in the book of Esther, but is God in control? Does God rule in the kingdoms of men even when you don't see him ruling in the kingdoms of men? Now, where did we hear that line? The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. Daniel chapter 4, I think it is. Who learned that lesson? Nebuchadnezzar. And so that's what we see happening in this book, even though God's not named. We see God's hand in the events. But do you see God's hand in the beginning or do you see it in the end? Well, you see it in the end. Does Mordecai know for sure God's going to work it out and save their skin in the beginning? He knows God can save them. And he knows God, that Esther could be an instrument by which he would save his people. But he doesn't know for sure. Have you ever prayed, God, please help me to know what to do. Help me to see. Help me to make the right choices. Help me to know where to work, how best to work. And still not know for sure what you're supposed to do. And then years later you think, oh, I don't know whether that was God's will or not. Sometimes we don't know what God's will is in regard to individual choices today, but we know that God will help those who love Him. So that's really important for us to trust Him. Notice some of these reversals. Here is Esther. She's a parentless slave, or at least a poor maiden in the kingdom of Persia, but what does she become? She becomes queen in the empire. Then Mordecai has what built for him? A place to hang him, gallows, and he then becomes second in the empire. Haman, who has great power, then is hung on the gallows built for Mordecai. The Jews look like they're about to be exterminated, but they're able to kill 75,000 of their dreaded enemies. So we see the greatness of God, and when times look like they're terrible, can we turn that down just a tad? I'm loaded. There we go. The ringing probably hurts yours. Thank you very much, fellas. So let's look at some personal qualities of Esther. I have two girls, and those of us as fathers who have girls or girls only, I think it's really helpful for us to see that although we understand roles and we understand the submissive, helpful role of the woman, I'm afraid we have failed to realize how great women are as spiritual leaders in the kingdom. Spiritual leaders on the team. Spiritual leaders at school. Not in a usurping authority over men, but because of courage and because of conviction and because of personal choices. Women make tremendous choices for good for hundreds or thousands or even millions of people in the case of Esther. And so, young ladies, please never think that, well, just because I'm not a man, I cannot be a spiritual influence. Most men who are worth their salt had their greatest influence where? From mom. That's right. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Ladies, the greatest work that you'll do as a wife and mother is to give your children to the Lord. Now let me say something else. You may never have the privilege or even have the desire to be a wife and mother. And that's fine too. Because there is great work to be done by those who are not married in the kingdom. And we have become a society that thinks you've got to be married or you're not whole. That's not true. But there is great things to be done by the women of God who rock their children and rock their grandchildren and teach them God's Word day after day, year after year, and wrestle with them and think, why am I here? Here because you're teaching them to love God. And you're making great choices at school. You're not going to read that trash. You're not going to talk like it. It's incredible what young women say today. I could hear it clear across the field. A girl that was helping a bricklayer, it was just putrid. And God's ladies don't talk that way. God's men don't talk that way. And you look at the qualities. Here she is, a young woman, and her mom and dad are dead. What often happens when mom and dad die when you're young? You split for the devil. You say, nobody loves me. God hates me. Nobody cares about me. Nobody is interested in me. I'm just going to live however I want to live. She didn't do that. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter. He is to be commended. But she continued to respect and obey him even after she becomes queen. She's still doing, she's still listening. And moms, haven't you found it that when you have newborns, that you're not going to talk to your girlfriends about how do I deal with this thing? You're wanting to talk to somebody who's older, somebody who's had children. You're looking for grandmotherly advice. Ladies, please understand, I know it would be more for easy for you to give that advice to young women if they would simply what? Ask. Young ladies, ask. Don't be afraid to ask your mother or some other mother, someone that is godly, that you appreciate. Ask them. They can give you a wealth of information and a wealth of encouragement and help. Don't be afraid to ask. And when your kids get to be teenagers, you think the diapers are tough? And I have wonderful girls. They've been very much reared by their mother. And they're a blessing in our lives. But there are challenges all along the way. And I thought it was tough before they couldn't drive. It causes you to stay awake even at night when they can drive. You remember those nights when you wish they would go to sleep? Then there's those nights when you wish you knew where they were. There are great potential opportunities here. She remembered God in her youth. Had she not, she could have not saved her people. Her beauty. She was really beautiful. She was not just beautiful of face. She had a beautiful figure. She was beautiful of form. King chose her. He had lots to choose from. But he chose her. Do you think there were any other girls that were as pretty as Esther? Think there were any other girls as pretty as Esther? He saw something in Esther that he didn't see in the others. Do you think men still do that today, ladies? Do you think that they actually look beyond your face and your figure? You know these Hollywood things where this guy has, what, 20 girls to choose from? Does he ultimately just choose the one that you thought was the prettiest? Or does he look beyond simply physical beauty to see character? Reputation is what other people think about you. Character is who you are. And character is what causes a person to survive and what makes them truly beautiful. You know, there's only so much you can do with size and shape and nosiness or eyes or whatever. But there's a whole lot you can do with character. Just a tremendous amount you can do with character. God looks on the heart. Are you beautiful to God? You notice that women who are godly get prettier as they get older? You notice that? Oh, they may be suffering from osteoporosis. The gray hair's not gray anymore. It's just plum silver. And yet the character of that person, because of their love of God and their desire to be like Him, just makes them radiant. Ladies, grow beautiful. Grow beautiful. You do that over time as God works on your character. Something else I'd like for you to note, and I realize that a lot of this is really teen material. Randy told me to speak loud enough so they could hear it in their class. I don't know what class he's teaching downstairs. But look at this young woman. She is a virgin. Now, I realize I'm talking to adults, but you need to share this with your children. Don't believe everything you hear in the locker room. You know, everybody in the locker room tells you that all the other girls are not virgins anymore. And the guys, the same story. Don't believe them. There's a lot of talk that's not backed up with fact. There are a lot of young people who are saying no. There are a lot of young people who are making good choices. And whether they do or not, because of whom you serve, you say no to sexual immorality. You say no not because of the potential for herpes. You say no not because of the potential for AIDS. You say no because you belong to God. He bought you. The blood of His Son has made you a holy temple. And that's why you say no. And parents, we need to share this with our children. We don't need to wring our hands and say, oh, I just hope you don't get pregnant. That's not the motive. What motivates spiritual conduct is a recognition of who God is. Worship motivates work for God. And when we see Him clearly, we seek to be like Him. Then when you notice in chapter 4, she is called upon to plead with the king in verse 8 for her people. She is being asked to risk her very life. It's almost like, have you ever been asked, oh, will you go talk to the principal for us? And you think, oh no, the principal. And you think he's just the worst ogre ever. Well, this is a lot bigger than that. Indeed, she's being asked to petition the king of the most powerful empire in the world for the lives of herself and her loved ones and all of her kin, all of the Jewish people. It is easy to tend to think that, no, look, it won't happen to me. The king wouldn't let me die. The king wouldn't let cousin Mordecai die. We're good people. We're good church people. Bad things can't happen to us. We live in Maiden City, West Virginia, America. Bad things can't happen to us. We're good people. Oh, yeah. There was this 9/1:1 that brought us a wake-up call that we're as vulnerable as anybody in the world to be obliterated by anybody's rage. And indiscriminate, terrible things happen in this world. And yet sometimes malicious, intentional efforts to destroy peoples, 6 million of them in a very few years. And some people will lie about it and say it never happened. Well, I'll take you to some places that will argue against that. And so we tend to think it can't happen to me. She had a life and death decision to make. We need to understand that judgments will come. And it's tempting to think that God's punishment for disobedience doesn't apply to me. Oh, he wouldn't send me to a devil's hell. Oh, yeah? No, because I'm Church of Christ. Because I came from good stock. I came from a good community. I came from the right place. You rebel against God. You disregard God's will. And you'll get a wake-up call. It'll be too late. And she needed to be reminded. And Mordecai said, do not think that just because you are in the court of the king, that you'll escape. Listen to the words. Verse 13 of chapter 4. Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. And you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Could she have remained silent? Could she have just not said anything? Not gone to the king, not told about her nationality? Could she have done that? Sure, she could have done that. What would have been the consequences? Wouldn't be reading the book of Esther, would we? Wouldn't be reading about the Christ based on this plan as we read about it. Everything that turns out good in this story pivots upon her decision and her action to petition the king on behalf of her people. Was this a convenient time for her to go and talk to the king? Convenient time? She hasn't seen the king how long? 30 days. He hasn't called for it. It's not a good time. Timing is everything, right? When is the convenient time for me to talk to my neighbor about Christ? What'd you say? Now. It never seemed convenient to me. I'm either dirty, I'm unshaven, I'm stinky, I've got grass all over me, or it's just a bad time, I'm having a bad day, or they're probably busy, they don't want me to call right now. Is there ever a convenient time to talk to somebody about their soul? Not really. Unless you decide that that's imperative. That I have got to speak for Christ. I have got to tell this person about Jesus Christ. I've got to let them know that I care. And then we make a convenient season. But it's not going to come on its own. If she cared about the salvation of her people, she would make the opportunity. She risked death in doing so. So many times I'm afraid I just remain silent. I just do. I wimp out when I should be speaking out, inviting people to consider Jesus. What else does she do? She has a huge decision to make. Before she goes in to talk to the king, she takes 3 days to do what? Pray and fast. If it was important enough to do, it was important enough to pray about. you're typically not going to speak to people about their soul if you're not willing to do what for them? Pray for them. What's your refrigerator look like? I'm not spying on anybody's refrigerator. We've got stuff on our refrigerator. Pictures, things like that. Calendars. Is there somewhere in your home that you have a list? A list of people that you're praying for? Do you have a prayer list? You will. If you pray for somebody long enough, you will find the courage with God's strength to speak to them about the Lord. But if you never take the time to write down their name and pray to our Heavenly Father for them, on behalf of them, you're most likely not apt to speak to them about God. Where's your prayer list? How long has it been since we fasted because of our concern spiritually for someone's soul? Well, we must not doubt or lose faith in God. What would she have been thinking? What did Joseph think when he was down in Egypt? Who cares? Dad evidently doesn't care. The boys, brothers think I'm not worth living. And where's my God? She could have thought the same thing. God, let my parents die. Here I am 900 miles away from home. Who cares what I do? Was that her response? No, she continued to hold on to faith and trust in God. We cannot foresee the remarkable ways that God can make things work together for good. But we must trust Him. God, with Esther being used by Him, made a difference. She made a difference by standing up and risking her life to save her people. Even 40 years later, I want you to kind of work on this one. I'm not sure about it, so I want you to do some work on it. Even 40 years later, her influence was felt in Nehemiah's return to Jerusalem. What would be a unique statement in chapter 2, verse 6 of Nehemiah? You'll read it and find out. I would suggest to you there may be some influence of Esther, even 40 years later. God can make a difference in our lives if we'll let Him. But we have to let Him. We have to say, as we see the greatness of a God and His holy, holy, holy character, to say, here am I, send me. Oh, not because I'm worthy, but because you're worthy. Please cleanse me, please purify me, but use me in your service as a servant. Esther did. And young ladies, and ladies who are not quite so young anymore, you can too. Thank you very much.